to earn my time. There are a lot of things I freely give to everyone in my organizations: vision, belief, resources, support, and leadership. One thing that must always be earned is my time. That is the most limited of my personal resources, so it must be earned before I give it. How does someone do that? By being a productive member on a team. In this, I practice the 80-20 principle. I give 80% of my time to the 20% of people on my team that produce 80% of the results. Earlier in my career, I spent a lot of time with unproductive people, thinking I could change them. I was so naive. As I mentioned, at first I just wanted to win everyone over. Later, I started to think about people's potential, and I would ask, will they do it? Can they do it? And is it worth the effort to ask them? I place the same standard on myself. Just because I enjoy a friendship with someone doesn't mean that I get a pass on productivity. For example, for several years, Tom and Todd Mullen included me on the teaching team of Christ Fellowship Church. Tom is the founding pastor, Todd is the son, and he's the lead pastor. Both are good friends, and I've loved every minute of my time teaching. However, every year I ask them this question: do you want me on this team again this year, or do you want to make a change? They know I am always ready to step down for the sake of the team. If I can't be productive for them, it's time for me to go. If you work for someone, value that person's time and be aware that you need to earn it. If others work for you, give your own time only to those who are productive and who are willing to learn, grow, and keep earning it. Always take responsibility. Most people want empowerment when what they first need are responsibility and accountability. As Kevin Turner, who is the vice chairman of the board of managers for Albertsons and senior advisor to the company's chairman and CEO, said, people want to be judged by their intentions, not by their actions. But results are what make a difference, not good intentions. And results come only when people take responsibility for themselves. I like what business executive Seth Godin said about this. Employees wait to be picked for promotion or to lead a meeting or to speak up at a meeting. Pick me, pick me, acknowledges the power of the system and passes responsibility to someone else to initiate. Even better, pick me, moves the blame from you to them. If you don't get picked, it's not your fault, it's theirs. And if you don't get picked, well, they said you were good, right? It's not your fault anymore. Reject the tyranny of picked. Pick yourself. That's what taking responsibility is. It's picking yourself. It's motivating yourself. It's bringing intentionality and energy to everything that you do. Speaking of energy, that's an area where I especially expect people to take responsibility because, sadly, the lowest energy level often brings the team down. People with negative energy and attitudes can take the team lower faster than people with positive energy can take it up. This is especially true in meetings. So how does a leader deal with this problem? I start by having energy check-ins at the beginning of meetings. I simply ask each person in the room what their energy level number is as I start a meeting. This motivates everyone to be fully present in the room. If needed, I put everyone's name and number on the board, and then I let them know what level of energy is needed from everyone in the room for us to be successful in the meeting. People usually take responsibility to raise their energy to the level of expectations, and it helps the meeting to have high energy and positive results. We will not avoid tough conversations. Leadership demands that we tackle the problems. That includes tough conversations. And their difficulty increases when the issue is not easy and it involves people on our team. But we should never delay tough conversations. The more you wait, the more difficult they become. Why? Silence to most people means approval. When people have to fill in the blanks themselves, they do so negatively. Problems left unaddressed have a snowball effect. They become larger and they gain momentum. problems left unaddressed cause inner erosion. We lose respect for ourselves internally. The law of diminishing intent is in effect. The longer you wait to do something you should do now, the greater the odds that you will never do it. One of these days becomes none of these days. Back in the days when I directly supervised a lot of staff, I used to tell them, never worry about how you are doing. I will let you know immediately if there's a problem. I don't sit on issues. If I need to have a tough conversation, I have it as soon as humanly possible. You've probably heard the saying that's all well that ends well. I also believe that all is well that begins well. That's what establishing upfront expectations does for you as a leader. It helps you to begin well so that you can challenge people to become their best. Number four, ask yourself the hard questions before any potentially difficult conversation. As I grew in my leadership from pleasing people to challenging people, I had to work hard at becoming better at difficult conversations. One of the questions I began asking myself was, what is the source of the problem prompting the need for this challenging conversation? Is it an external issue? Is it a problem with any other person? Or is it me? If the issue was external, like poor communication, a bad system, or an external problem, it would be easy to solve. If a problem was related to the person's attitude or actions, it would be more difficult. If the fault was mine, then I might not need to meet with the other person at all. I just needed to own up to it and fix myself. If it was any combination of the three, then the conversation would be very difficult because of the complexity. As you think about any difficult conversation you're getting ready to have, I want to give you some help. Here are some questions that I've used before having difficult conversations to help me prepare for that time. Questions such as, have I invested in the relationship enough to be candid with them? Do I demonstrate that I value them as individuals? Am I sure that this is their issue, not mine? Am I sure I'm not speaking up because I feel threatened? Is the issue more important than the relationship? Does this conversation clearly serve their interest and not just mine? Am I willing to invest time and energy to help them change? Am I willing to show them how to do something and not just say what's wrong? Am I willing and able to set clear, specific expectations? Have I previously addressed the issue or problem in a less formal setting? If you have one or more no responses to any of the questions I just read, consider what steps you need to take to make that no become a yes before you conduct that crucial conversation. Number five, when a tough conversation is needed, do it right. Because it was once so difficult for me, I want to give you some advice about how to make tough conversations less tough. First, remember why you're having the conversation. It's because you care about the other person. You care enough to confront them. Your goal is to help that person. Having the right attitude is essential because your actions often carry more weight than words, and a negative attitude can cause more damage. People remember how they felt long after they've forgotten what you said. You can communicate the right attitude by seeking to understand, and here's a roadmap for that conversation. State the issue clearly at the beginning. Use the phrase, "Are you aware that?" Ask them to tell their perspective. Start with the phrase, "I need you to help me understand your situation." Ask questions such as, am I hearing you correctly? Repeat back what you heard. Allow them to respond. Now try to find some common ground and arrive at agreement on what's best for both of you. And if you cannot come to an agreement on the issue and solution, agree to meet again. See the growth opportunity that lies within the tough conversation and seek at all times to maintain a positive relationship with that person. Following this pattern and arriving at a positive outcome is not always possible, but it is worth trying to attain. You're always better off having a tough conversation and finding out where you stand rather than avoiding it and hoping that the problem will resolve itself, because it never does. Number 6. Understand the 25-50-25 principle. Good leadership always challenges people to rise to the occasion, become their best, and achieve more. Some people accept the challenge and help the team win, and others don't. As a leader, you have to manage the process that people go through. You can use the 25-50-25 principle to help you. I learned about it years ago when I attended a leadership roundtable in Los Angeles. Here's how it goes. Whenever you cast vision and challenge people to become part of achieving an endeavor, they tend to fall into one of three groups. Typically, 25% of the people will support your efforts. 50%, they'll be undecided. And 25%, they'll resist the change. Your job is to help the middle 50% join the first 25%. Here are the tips for doing that and working with all three groups. Understand that the resistant bottom 25% are not going to join you no matter what you do. The greatest leader in the world could be leading them and they would still resist change. Just accept that. Don't waste your effort trying to make the bottom 25% happy. They're not going to be happy. Trying to placate them will only encourage their resistance. Don't give the bottom 25% a platform or credibility. If you believe you're doing the right thing, why would you help them undermine that? Try to keep the bottom 25% away from the 50% who have not yet made up their minds. As baseball manager Casey Stengel said, "The secret of managing is to keep the guys who hate your guts away from the guys who haven't made up their minds yet." Ask the 25% who support you to help positively influence the middle 50% who are undecided. And give the supportive 25% credibility and a platform to speak. They will help you help the organization move forward. Any movement you can create in the middle 50% toward your leadership and the vision is a win, because it takes the organization in the right direction. Celebrate that and keep moving forward. Number 7, balance care with candor. I want to give you one more piece of advice related to challenging people, and it's an important one. As a leader, you need to bring both caring and candor into the relationship. I'll explain why that's so important in a moment. But first, let me set it up for you by explaining one of the core teachings I use to develop leaders. It's called the 5 levels of leadership. It illustrates a process whereby people can develop influence with others. Here's a brief description of each of the 5 levels. The first level, which is the lowest, is the position level. It's based on rights, where people follow you because they have to. You have the title. You have the position. Number 2 is the permission level. It's based on relationships, and that's where people follow you because they want to. In fact, they give you permission to lead them. Level 3 is the production level. It's based on results, and this is where people follow you because you really help the team get better. You help the company. You are a producer. Level 4 is the people development level, and that's based on reproduction, where now people follow you because you've improved them personally. You have reproduced yourself in them. You have been their mentor. Their life is better because of you. Level 5, the highest level, is the pinnacle level. It's based on respect. This is where people follow you because you help them become leaders at level number 4 themselves. You've helped them so much and reproduced yourself in them that you become bigger than life. In the 40 years, I've used the 5 levels of leadership to train and develop leaders. I've observed that the most difficult step for leaders is to take the step from level 2 to level 3. Almost any likable person can develop a relationship with people on level 2, caring about them, connecting with them. But level three is about production, making the transition from getting people to like you to getting people to produce better results. And that can be daunting. And reproducing yourself on level four by investing in another person and helping him or her become a leader is even more difficult. How does a leader move others from "I like being on the team" to "I need to produce for the team"? The answer is to balance care and candor. I mention this because most people naturally default to one or the other. But here's why it's important for you to practice both. Care without candor creates a dysfunctional relationship. Candor without care creates a distant relationship. Care balanced with candor develops and creates a developing relationship. Care and candor are like the two wings of a plane. You can't fly with only one. They must work together. Care is the left wing of the plane, and candor is the right. Care values the person, where candor values the person's potential. Care establishes the relationship. What candor does is it expands the relationship. When you care for people, you're shoring up their weaknesses, but with candor, you can help bring out their strengths. Care offers comfort, whereas candor offers a challenge. Care makes the team pleasant, but candor makes the team productive. Caring should never suppress candor, while candor should never displace caring. When I have the responsibility for leading people, I must care for them, but I must also challenge them by initiating honest conversation to help them improve. My mindset should be, I love you too much to let you stay where you are. That thinking was difficult for me when I was a young leader. Caring was easy. Candor was difficult. Today I'm able to sit down with people and have honest, tough conversations with them. But the principle that guides me is a saying I adopted long ago. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. That helps me to keep the right balance of care and candor. It's been almost 50 years since I made the leadership from pleasing people to challenging them. It's been one of the most difficult challenges I've had to make in my leadership, but it has also been one of the most rewarding. If I hadn't been willing to face up to the need to change, I'd have gotten stuck in my leadership. I don't know how much difficulty people-pleasing has given you. Maybe it's not an issue at all. I hope that's the case. But no matter what, you need to learn how to positively challenge people if you desire to become the best leader that you can be. If you can help people to positively reach their potential, you help them, your team, and yourself. Together we have just finished reading Chapter 5, that leadership that goes from pleasing people to challenging people. In my early leadership years, I had a wiser, more experienced mentor say to me that, "John, leadership is disappointing people at a rate that they can stand." And when I first heard that, I thought, wow, that's got a lot of cynicism in it, and it's got a lot of negativism, because I was not a mature leader. What I didn't realize was the fact that he was teaching me that there had to be a process in developing leaders, and that process was, as a leader, know where the people are so you can take them where they need to go. And there are some people, they can't go as fast as others. I have to literally find them before I can lead them. And this chapter, I love it because it's all about helping people reach their potential. And I cannot help you reach your potential. You can't help me reach my potential unless you bring the best out of me. And you can't bring the best out of me by making me happy. I can still remember many years ago when I was on a book tour with the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership, and I was during a break and I was signing the books as there was a line of people. And a gentleman came up to me and he handed me the 21 Laws book, and I'm signing it, and he looked at me and he said, "You know, I disagree with one of the laws you have in the book." And I finished signing the book and handed it back to him. I said, "Well, that's okay." But I could tell immediately when I said that was okay, it really wasn't okay. So he looked right at me. He said, I don't think you heard me. He said, "I disagree with one of the laws of leadership in your book." And And again, I looked at him, and I smiled, and I said, well, that's okay with me. Well, it was at that time and moment I realized that it was not okay with him, that it was okay with me about him disagreeing with one of the laws. And so he pressed me one more time. He said, look, he said, I tell you, I just don't agree with one of the laws in your leadership book. And I looked at him and I smiled. And now out comes the chapter that we've just read together. I looked at him and I said, you know, I got it. I got it. And it still is okay. And let me explain something. I wrote the book to help you, not to make you happy. I'm a leader, not a clown. Now, obviously, when I said that, somebody would say, oh my gosh, what a strong, courageous statement. Well, it was a statement that was birthed out of making the leader shift years earlier of going from pleasing people to helping people and challenging them. I mean, if the guy, when he says he doesn't agree with one of the laws of leadership, that's like you say, I disagree with the law of gravity. Well, you may do that, but if you go up to a four-story building and jump off, very quickly you're going to buy into the law of gravity. The law doesn't ask you if you like it. It just says, you know, learn it so that I can help you. Well, that's what this chapter is all about. Chapter 5 is all about loving people enough that you are willing to do the strong, hard things to help them and make them better. I love that statement. I love you too much to leave you as you are. That's beautiful. In other words, I'm willing to be uncomfortable myself to say something that perhaps will make you uncomfortable, because I really care for you and see your potential. When people really love you, they'll be honest with you. And they'll say things many times that you don't want to hear, but that you and I need to hear. Well, that's chapter 5. I'm so excited about being with you. I hope you're enjoying the book. I'm enjoying reading it to you. I'm enjoying my little comments at the end of each chapter. Because I value you. I value you as a person. I value you as a listener of one of my books. Let's take the journey together. Let's go to chapter 6. Chapter 6, Maintaining to Creating, The Abundant Shift. Vince Lombardi said, "The joy is in creating, not maintaining." Have you ever thought about the expectations your profession or your industry places on you? Are people on your leadership position expected to hold the line, maintain the course, change direction, get out of the box, blow up the box? When I started my career, it never occurred to me to think about such things. I knew from a fairly early age that I was going to become a pastor. That determined my course of study in college, and after I graduated, I was happy to find my first job in rural Indiana. A few weeks after Margaret and I got married, we moved there and off we went. That was back in 1969. In those days, the role of pastors was pretty set. We were expected to be shepherds, and our main job was to feed and care for the flock. The whole mindset was maintaining. As much as I loved the people of my congregation, and I look forward to being a pastor, it wasn't long before I started to feel unsettled. Each year, the organization I belonged to held a meeting for pastors and leaders of all the churches. Toward the end of my first year on the job, I went to my initial meeting as the leader of my own church. It was good to see some friends from college and to catch up with them. But what struck me most was how traditional everything was. The highlight of the meeting was when the pastor of the year was recognized. For the first time it struck me. The people they honored were always the ones with the longest tenure, the leaders who were faithful, the maintainers. I did not want to be a maintainer. Tenure wasn't my goal. And I began to feel like a misfit among a group of people who valued tradition and conformity, and my sense of unsettledness only increased. And the way the organization worked, if you were a faithful shepherd at a small church and didn't rock the boat, you were eventually invited to pastor a larger church. If you were faithful there, you would get offered a denominational position. The recognized pastors maintained their way to the top, and on it went until you received recognition toward the end of your career as you approached retirement. I could see the whole path ahead of me, and I was beginning to suspect that it wasn't a good fit for me. I wanted to innovate. I wanted to reach people. I wanted to build a great church. Years later, someone in the ministry world pointed out that all pastors are not actually shepherds. He referred instead to another analogy, church leader as a rancher. He described the difference this way. While shepherds are maintainers who care for the sheep they already have, ranchers are leaders who pioneer new ideas and build. Now, I'm not saying that people are livestock, but there's a difference in mindset between those two types of people, and it was clear which type I was. I wanted to build. There's an old saying, don't tear down a fence until you know why it's there. Within my organization, I wasn't someone who was itching to tear down fences, but I was a questioner. I was very quick to ask why a fence had been put up, and whether it still needed to be there, and if it could be replaced by something better. If the reason something was done was reasonable, then I'd leave it alone. If not, then I started asking, why not do it another way, a better way? Asking questions and exploring ignited my creativity. Although within my organization it seemed like I was the only one doing that, in fact, my questions annoyed them. They questioned my questions. They couldn't understand why I was asking them at all. It eventually became clear to me that I wasn't compatible with the culture and I needed to make a change. So I left the organization. Recognize what zone you're in. I don't want to put down the organization I was a part of or the people I grew up with. They were good people. However, I believe the culture they were part of was working against them. It's difficult overcoming a maintaining culture. And if you also happen to have an inherent tendency toward inactivity, when it comes to innovation, you have even more to overcome. I've observed that we all tend to fall into one of four different zones when it comes to innovation, which impacts how we live and how we lead and how we achieve. Here are the zones along with the attitude statements that represent them. First, there's the coasting zone, which basically I say if I'm there, I do as little as possible. Or, secondly, there's the comfort zone. The comfort zone person says, well, I do what I've always done. Well, thirdly, there's the challenge zone, which is where I attempt to do what I haven't done before. And finally, number four is the creative zone. I attempt to think what I never even thought before. Now, which zone do you naturally gravitate to? Do you tend to live in the coasting zone, casually, even passively, doing as little as possible? Do you tend to stay in the comfort zone, just purely avoiding risk? Or do you connect with the challenge zone, where you try new things and willingly risk failure? Or do you try to stretch yourself the furthest by living in the creative zone, where you explore new ideas, seek out other perspectives, and cross bridges in your imagination long before you physically reach them? The good news is that we have the ability to choose a zone different from our natural one, and I recommend the creative zone, because it is where we experience abundance and expand our potential. If you want to take your leadership to ever higher levels, you need to make the leadership from maintaining to creating and try to live in the creative zone. Unlock the mental blocks that keep you out of the creative zone. How can you make the shift from maintaining to creating? I believe you must start the process from the inside out. Begin by removing some of the mental blocks that cripple so many people's creative potential. Roger Vano wrote extensively about many of them in his book, A Whack on the Side of the Head. I've included some of my favorites. Which of these phrases do you find yourself thinking or saying? Mental block number one, find the right answer. It's wrong to believe that there is only one right answer to any question. There are always other solutions. If you believe that they are there and we're willing to look for them, guess what? We will find them. Mental block number two. That's not logical. Albert Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world. Imagination turns possibilities into reality. It's willing to take leaps that logic cannot. While logic does have great value and you should keep it, you should intentionally add creativity. Mental block number 3. Follow the rules. I've always loved this quote from Thomas Edison. There ain't no rules around here. We're trying to accomplish something. Most revolutionary ideas have been disruptive violations of set rules. Mental block number 4. Avoid ambiguity. Life is complex. It's messy. It's contradictory and paradoxical. Why in the world would we think we should or could avoid ambiguity? There is never one fixed way to understand something. Everything can be understood in more than one way. Mental block number 5. Failure is bad. Creative people don't avoid failure. They see it as a friend. They know that if they are to experiment, innovate, and create, they will fail. They embrace risk. Mental block number 6. Don't be foolish. To stand up is to stand out. You have to stick your neck out to put your head above the crowd. If others don't at first understand or accept you, so what? All the great dreamers look foolish to someone. How you are perceived by others is less important than how effective you can be. Mental block number 7. I'm not creative. The mental block that most keeps us from being creative is believing we don't possess creativity. This self-perception is a barrier to talent, opportunity, and intelligence. But the truth is that everyone can learn to be creative. The only real block to creativity is our disbelief. I love what blogger Hugh McLeod said about this. He said, everyone is born creative. Everyone is given a box of crayons in kindergarten. Then when you hit puberty, they take the crayons away and replace them with dry, uninspiring books on algebra, history, etc. Being suddenly hit years later with the creative bug is just a wee voice telling you, I'd like to have my crayons back, please. Creative principles to learn and live by. If you want to shift from maintaining to creating in your life and in your leadership, then you need to take your crayons back. And here's how. Number 1. Build a creative culture. If you lead a team, department, or organization, take responsibility for promoting creativity and building a creative culture. Several years ago, I read an article in Forbes that took tips from Disciplined Dreaming by Josh Lichtner. And they provide great insights in how to make your organization's culture more creative. I've interpreted his ideas, plus added a few of my own. For example, fuel passion. Creativity requires time, tenacity, testing, options, U-turns, imaginations, questions, failure, and change. All these things require a lot of energy. Passion provides the fuel. Celebrate ideas. What gets celebrated gets done. If you reward ideas with money, praise, and opportunity, people will come to value ideas and work toward generating and sharing them. Foster autonomy. George S. Patton said, never tell people how to do things. Tell them what to do, and they will surprise you with their ingenuity. What he was really talking about was allowing people to have enough autonomy to be creative. Micromanagement undermines creativity, while freedom and flexibility foster it. Encourage courage. Creativity requires risk, and taking risk requires courage. As a leader, you need to model it and encourage it. As Daniel R. Dennison of IMD Business School said, there's always a premium on being able to deal with the unknown. People will venture there if they feel they'll be secure in doing it. It's the leader's job to create that sense of security. Minimize hierarchy. In creative environments, decisions are made closest to the problems. For that to happen, leaders need to minimize the number of layers between the top and the bottom. A few years ago, I read an article by Robert Kaplan in which he interviewed now-retired General Stanley McChrystal, who said, "Any complex task is best approached by flattened hierarchies. It gets everybody feeling like they're in the inner circle so that they can develop a sense of ownership." Reduce rules. Author Henry David Thoreau said, "Any fool can make a rule and every fool will mind it." Creativity gets stifled when everyone expends too much energy worrying about following rules. Too many rules cause idea anemia. General Douglas MacArthur said, "You are remembered for the rules you break." I like that idea. Fail forward. I once saw a sign that said, company motto, "We make new mistakes." I love that. I'm a huge supporter of the idea of failing forward, so much that I wrote an entire book on that subject. If you fall down, you should learn from it, get up, and step forward. Anytime you learn what doesn't work, you're a step closer to what does work. Start small. Too often, we want huge breakthroughs and innovations when we should be looking for small ones. If you want one great idea, look for a lot of good ideas. If you want to create something significant, build it in small increments. Do that consistently, and you make creative progress. The more you foster creativity in the environment you influence, the more you instill an abundance mindset. That's why I call this leadership the abundance shift. It's like poet Maya Angelou said, "You can't use up creativity. The more you use, the more you have." Sadly, too often, creativity is smothered rather than nurtured. There has to be a climate in which new ways of thinking, perceiving, questioning are encouraged. As a leader, you have the influence and obligation to try to create that climate. Number two, make everything better. You've probably heard the expression, "It doesn't get any better than this." Well, I have news for you. It can get better. Everything can get better. And as leaders, we should be catalysts for improvement. We need to champion the idea expressed by poet James Russell Lowell, who said, "Creativity is not the finding of a thing, but making something out of it after it's found." I have a process for making things better that I use with my team. I call it 10-80-10. Whenever we start on a task or project, the first thing I do is identify the target, which represents approximately 10% of the process. So, the first 10 of 10-80-10 focuses on knowing what we want to accomplish. After all, how can I find what I don't know what I'm looking for? This sets up the next part of the process, which is the 80%. The focus here is production. Now that the task has been set in the right direction, the team finds the way to execute it. Sometimes they have to try new things out, practice different approaches, or find out what works. I've observed that when most teams reach this point, the leader is done. However, there is one more step to take to a whole new level. This is the final 10 in the 10-80-10. This last 10% is like putting the cherry on the top. Once the team has the strategy and the process down and everything's working, I see if there is a way to make it even better. Can we take an idea to the next level? Can we target a message even more sharply? Can we make a client's experience even better? Can we add something to an event to make it spectacular? Is there anything important that the rest of the team didn't see because they were too far into the weeds and didn't have perspective? What can we do to go the extra mile? This phase is where great innovation often occurs, and we are able to maximize ideas. It's also the reason we as a team are so often able to exceed expectations. Number three, make plans, but look for options. No doubt good leaders use plans to get things done, but planning is not the end-all and be-all of leadership. Leaders who cling to inflexibility to a plan stifle creativity and miss opportunities. To be creative, leaders need to add options to their planning. I think of this as moving from plan A to option A. I'll explain that in a moment, but first, I want to talk to you about planning. The first definition of planning that I ever learned was this. Planning is predetermining tomorrow's results today. I love that definition. It's so specific. It offers a promise of control over tomorrow through what we are doing right now. As a young leader, I wanted to and needed some certainties in my life that I could rely upon, and planning looked like it would be one of them. Every day, I would plan my work and I would work my plan. I even thought of myself as a man with a plan. 10-year plan? I had it. 5-year plan? Check. 2-year plan? On paper, in detail, I was ready to let anybody read it. My personality was controlling, and planning put me in control. I was also aided by living in Hillham, Indiana, a small farming community where very little changed. I felt on top of everything. But as I progressed in my leadership, planning became more complicated. But my understanding of it also dealt with that complexity. A decade into my leadership career, I was teaching a seminar entitled Plan Ahead. Here's what I taught other leaders to do. The letter P in the word plan, predetermine your course of action. The letter L, lay out your goals. The letter A, adjust your priorities. And the letter N, notify key personnel. The A in the word ahead stood for allow time for acceptance. H, head into action. E, expect problems. A, adjust your plan. And then D, daily review your plans. Notice my planning formula now included adjust your priorities, allow time for acceptance, expect problems, adjust your plan, daily review your plans. Why? I had begun to learn that there was no perfect plan. You can't just sit down and plan tomorrow with certainty. You have no control over it. You don't control other people. Even controlling yourself can be a challenge. I had begun to make a leader shift from rigidly working on a set plan to regularly adapting my plan to deal with unaccounted problems, uncooperative people, and unexpected opportunities. I was growing, but I still had a long way to go. More than 2,000 years ago, Publius Sirius wrote, "It is a bad plan that admits no modifications." I believe what he really meant is that it is a bad leader whose plan does not allow modifications. Good leaders are flexible and their plans are fluid. They allow for creativity. They plan, but they look for options, and that's important. Options always present themselves soon after action is taken on a plan. If we don't open ourselves up to those options, we miss a chance to innovate, to create, and sometimes to win. In football, there is a game plan. It is developed before the game starts. For example, the offensive coordinator for a pro football team plans how the offense will attack. And before the game, he will often script the first 20 plays. Meanwhile, the defensive coordinator creates a plan against the other team's offense. But their plans don't always work, or they work less effectively than they had hoped. That's why coaches have to make adjustments. On his blog, author and speaker Steve Pavlina wrote about how good leaders look for options and make adjustments. Stephen Covey often used the expression, integrity in the moment of choice. What that means is that you should not follow your plan blindly without conscious awareness of your goals. For instance, let's say you're following your plan nicely, so far so good, and then an unforeseen opportunity arises. Do you stick with your original plan, thereby missing the opportunity, or do you stop and go after the opportunity, thereby throwing yourself off schedule? This is where you have to stop, reconnect with your goals to decide which is the better course. No plan should be followed blindly. As a young leader, I needed to learn to seek out options. Too often, I sought great security in my plan. I identified a single, solitary pathway. The good news is that I held to my plan and I made progress. The bad news is because I held to that plan, I missed opportunities that would have expanded my plans and my potential. Being inflexible and sticking to my plan put a lid on me and my organization. I'm not disparaging planning. It's essential for success. As the old Yogi Berra quote says, you've got to be careful if you don't know where you're going, because you might not get there. But the best leaders also adapt. They use options to their advantage. The more they're invested in their plans, the more likely they are to defend and hold on to them too long. It's a natural reaction, but not allowing themselves to see and explore options isn't creative, and it isn't good leadership. The best leaders are flexible. As leadership author Warren Bennis said, adaptive capacity allows leaders to respond quickly and intelligently to constant change. It is the ability to identify and seize opportunities. It allows leaders to act and then evaluate results instead of attempting to collect and analyze all the data before acting. One of the instances when I recognized the need to search for options came in my writing career. When I first started writing, I found it very difficult. The only way I wrote my first few books was through sheer discipline. I planned my work and then forced myself to follow it. Jeff Fisher said, discipline is doing what you really don't want to do so you can do what you really want to do. Well, that described me. When it came to writing, I really didn't want to do it. I wondered if there were any other options besides gritting my teeth and forcing myself to write. The first thing I did was ask myself why I enjoyed speaking. I was able to answer that in a single word: anticipation. Whenever I spoke, I anticipated a positive response from the audience. That immediate feedback was missing when I wrote. If you're familiar with the traditional publishing process for books, you know that after you finish a manuscript, you must wait an entire year before the book is published and your audience gets to read it. I asked myself, is there a creative way to create anticipation for my writing? Soon the ideas began to flow. I found a picture of an audience I had spoken to, printed a quote from a writing mentor, and placed both at my desk so that I could see them every day as I wrote. The quote said, I write books to extend my influence to people beyond my personal touch. Seeing the picture and the quote helped inspire me and build positive anticipation of my work's results. Today I don't need those prompts to inspire me to write. I'm at my desk at 5:30 most mornings, anxious to put words to paper. But if I encounter another problem, I'll go looking for options. Multiple options always help us to find solutions. Creativity is the joy of not knowing all the answers, but of knowing the answers are out there. We just need to find them. Number 4. Place high value on ideas. Harvey Firestone, one of the most successful businessmen of the 19th and early 20th centuries, said, capital isn't so important in business. Experience isn't so important. You can get both of these things. What is important is ideas. If you have ideas, you have the main assets you need, and there isn't any limit to what you can do with your business and with your life. They are any man's greatest asset. Ideas. If you want to be creative, you must place high value on ideas and learn how to generate them. You can by following this process. Start gathering ideas. I have been a collector of ideas all my life, and this practice has been the foundation for my ability to keep writing, speaking, and leading. I encourage you to look for ideas everywhere and glean them from everyone. Whenever you are successful in gathering ideas, do two things. File those you don't intend to use right away by title, and keep in front of you any ideas you're currently giving consideration. The first practice keeps you from losing ideas while you're seeking new ones, and the second practice enables you to look for connections between the ideas you found and whatever you are currently working on. Test every idea that you gather. The more ideas you test, the more likely you are to find one that works. Remember, just as there isn't one right answer to a problem, There isn't just one good idea. There are many. And when ideas are tested and put together, there might be many great ideas. Test every idea to see if it is, or if it could be, made to be great. Analyze your failures. Analyzing my failures has been a major help to me because I've experienced so many failures, flops, and fumbles. When an idea falls apart, take time to consider what went wrong and how you can learn from it. The only truly bad ideas are those that die without giving rise to other ideas. Great ideas are often nothing more than the restructuring of ideas that have failed. Adapt other ideas. Stanley Weston, creator of the action figure G.I. Joe, said, "True groundbreaking ideas are rare, but you don't necessarily need one to make a career out of creativity. My definition of creativity is the logical combination of two or more existing elements that result in a new concept. The best way to make a living with your imagination is to develop innovative applications, not imagine completely new concepts. Every successful idea is based on other ideas that precede and surround it. Taking existing ideas and adding to them is how the human race has made progress." Question all assumptions. Assumptions are creativity killers. If you assume there is not a better way, you won't find one. Assume that you have found the answer, and you won't find a better answer. Assume that it's never going to get any better, and it won't. When you're working to be creative, don't take anything for granted. Question, wonder, challenge. Go back to the beginning if necessary. The more open the mental playing field, the better your odds of finding new and better ideas. Number 5. Seek out and listen to different voices. Creativity thrives when one subject is approached from many different perspectives. It shortcuts the kind of one-way thinking that interferes with better solutions. If we get into single-perspective thinking, we find ourselves in ruts. If we see things from a new perspective, we can be like the mechanic who told his customer, "I couldn't repair your brakes, I just made the horn louder." Norman Vincent Peale said, "Ask the God who made you to keep remaking you." I do that. I try to remain teachable, and I listen to many different voices and perspectives to try to improve myself. That's why I always try to surround myself with the best and the brightest people that I can find. I like nothing more than to bring together a group of leaders, young and old, new and experienced, and ask them for their perspectives on a question, a problem, or a project. I'm a firm believer that in team, T-E-A-M principle, together, everyone accomplishes more. I want others' assessment. I love that word, assessment. It comes from the Latin accedere, which means to sit beside. I want people willing to sit beside me and share their perspectives, give their insights, add their ideas to mine, and make all of us better. From about the age of 40, I have greatly valued the help of my inner circle, the people closest to me in life and in business. These individuals compensate for my weaknesses, focus on today, and implement much of the work in my organizations. Most of these people have worked with me for many years, some for more than 2 decades. But over the last few years, I have intentionally cultivated another group that I call my outer circle. These people have fresh eyes and can speak to me from a different perspective. They enhance my strengths, help me focus on tomorrow, and give me creative ideas. The people in this group change frequently because it's based on time and opportunities. Together, both circles complement or empower each other and complete me. A couple of years ago, I felt I needed new input in my writing. I wanted an outsider's fresh perspective on how to improve. I invited someone into my outer circle to challenge me. The result? My writing became more reflective and personal. Conventional wisdom would warn not to mess with the success. I disagree. If you want to bless your success, mess with it. Get another perspective. Listen to other voices. Have the courage to let go of your certainties, challenge your assumptions, and change your way of doing things. It will make you more creative. Number 6. Take risk. I witnessed a fantastic example of creative risk-taking on January 8, 2018, in a college football playoff national championship game between the University of Alabama Crimson Tide and the University of Georgia Bulldogs. At the end of the first half, Coach Nick Saban's Alabama team was losing 13-0 because his offense was having no success against the tough defense of Jordan. That point spread may not sound like much, but in a game that was expected to be a defensive battle, 2 touchdowns seemed like a lot to overcome. Alabama's quarterback, Jalen Hurts, the sophomore, who had started every game and had set many Alabama records the previous year, didn't look like he would be capable of winning a shootout. So what could Saban do? Some coaches would have ramped up their defense to try to stop their opponents. Others might have tried running different offensive plays. Saban made another choice that was a huge risk. Thinking outside of the box, Saban started the second half with an untested freshman quarterback, Tua Tagovailoa. What a bold move. Tua had never started a college game and had very little playing time, yet he was asked to lead the team in the most pressure-filled game of the season. I've never before seen a coach change from a tested quarterback to an inexperienced freshman quarterback during the most important game of the season. Had Alabama lost, Saban would have been criticized mercilessly. But they didn't lose. Saban's creative risk changed the outcome of the game, and Alabama ended up winning the game 26-23 in overtime when they scored a touchdown on the pass by that freshman quarterback. That creative move was praised as the key to victory. Number 7. Live on the other side of yes. Recently, I was casting vision to a large group of leaders. There was a great sense of anticipation as I shared the possibilities and opportunities that could be before us if we partnered together and joined hands to accomplish this vision. After that session, I met in the green room with the top leaders of that organization, continuing to discuss the possibilities of working together. One of those leaders, Larry Stocksdale, interrupted the discussion and said, "John, the answer is yes. Count me in. Whatever this means, I'm a yes." His response energized the entire room, and everyone followed his positive lead. After the meeting, when Larry and I were together, I thanked him for his positive response, and I was curious, so I asked him what made him respond so boldly. "I live on the other side of yes," Larry said. "That's where I find abundance and opportunity. It's where I become a better and bigger self. The opportunity of a lifetime must be seized within the lifetime of the opportunity, so I try to say yes whenever I can." Larry's statement made a strong impression on me, and I love his phrase, "live on the other side of yes." I believe that what he's talking about is seizing opportunities. When we do that, we're like Lori Greiner, who wrote, "Dear optimist, pessimist, and realist, while you guys were busy arguing about the glass of water, I drank it. Sincerely, the opportunist." How could you become more opportunistic and live on the other side of yes? Imagine opportunities everywhere. Everything mankind has accomplished existed in someone's imagination before it became a reality. We create what we imagine, and imagination is one of the last remaining legal means that you have to gain what feels like an unfair advantage over your competition. And you can cultivate this imagination by asking questions. Curious people are imaginative people, and questions are doorways to opportunity. I love the story Tim Sanders tells about the little girl who kept asking her mother question after question. Finally, her mother cried, "For heaven's sake, stop asking so many questions. Curiosity killed the cat." After 2 minutes of thinking, the girl asked, "So, What did the cat want to know? Curiosity doesn't kill cats. It kills the competition because it identifies opportunities. Networking. You're only a few people away from a wonderful opportunity.